Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hey everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is wonderful to have your company for another episode of the show. Now, today we're talking about something that's really near and dear to my heart, and that is how to create a really human experience for our patients, but not just any old human experience, one that is delightful, one that is awe-inspiring, one that has people coming back again and again and telling their friends about how wonderful you are. And there's a bit of a misconception that customer experience does not scale. Well, today's guest, Joseph Michelli, is going to help you understand that that is just not true. Joseph is a New York Times bestselling author. He's written wonderful books about wonderful businesses, including Zappos, Mercedes-Benz, Starbucks, and others. And in my hot little hand right now, I have his book called Driven to Delight, which is an amazing book about Mercedes-Benz and their ascendancy. And so if you want to create a business that is really valuable, you want to create repeat business. You want to have repeatable, sustainable earnings. And that's what allows you to create enterprise value. So understanding what creates a wonderful experience, how to systemize it, how to hire for it, how to get the culture right around that is something that you want to pay attention to as a business owner. And in this podcast, Joseph shares very generously his knowledge, his experiences, examples, case studies about how to do all of that and a whole lot more. So please do have a pen and paper handy because there are so many pearls of wisdom in this podcast, so many nuggets of gold that I know you're going to want to take them and apply them and implement them into your business so that you can create not just enterprise value, but a wonderful experience that has your customers, your patients coming back again and again and again. So without any further ado, here's Joseph Michelli. Joseph, welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It is fantastic to have you here. I'm super excited to talk to you because I've read your books. I've studied some of the same companies you've written about, and I'm just delighted to have the opportunity to talk to someone who's obsessed about customer experience because I think there's so much there. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, at the risk of seeming creepy myself, I spent a lot of time on your website and I really appreciate what you've done for the dental industry.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate those kind words indeed. Why is it that customer experience caught your attention so much? What is it about that that fascinates you? And what has driven you to study all these great companies, whether it's Mercedes, Zappos, Pike Place Fish Markets? What's led you to kind of become curious and fascinated in that realm?
Well, I first have to blame my parents because we always have to blame our parents. And I'm a psychologist, all the more reason, I think. My parents told me you're put on this world to serve others, not to be served. And that was a fundamental truth. And it was helpful because, you know, once you focus on creating value instead of extracting value, you get a lot of value in return. So it was helpful, but I went to graduate school, became a psychologist, trained, worked in a hospital setting. And then I had the privilege of moving up and doing organizational development for a healthcare system. Uh-huh. And literally I had the Seventh-day Adventists and the Catholics merging together with different versions of how God was going to heal you as part of the course. It was a fabulous education. But in that time, I made so many mistakes, not least of which, as I was building this culture of trying to help people serve better in this hospital setting, we just gave people scripts and said, follow these scripts and, you know, we'll all be aligned and consistent. And that was largely because part of my job at the hospital was to elevate the customer service scores that we were getting. So I think I happened upon it because I was moving from being a clinical psychologist to an organizational developmental specialist. And I really got into it in the weeds when I was trying to merge a couple of cultures to make sure that this could come together in something that could really serve people.
What is it about the psychology that allowed you, or your psychological training, that has allowed you to, you know, really dive deep into customer experience and understanding why people do the things they do and what's important to individuals?
I think, you know, with psychology, we really focus on either activating change for people through their thoughts, through their feelings, or through their behaviors. You know, that kind of notion of fake it until you make it kind of thing. That's just do the behavior over and over again, and, you know, the thoughts and feelings will follow. And then the cognitive psychologist all said, change what you think about things and your feelings will follow. And the kind of gestaltist would say, hey, get into your feelings and dive in there and your thoughts and your behaviors will follow. Well, bottom line is, as someone who's trying to improve experiences, I'm trying to help organizations change the thinking and feeling of their people, but also change their behaviors so that they can sustain a culture that serves their customers well.
Yeah. We spoke a little bit off air about some of the books you've written, some of the companies you've had the opportunity to study, and some of the individuals you've had the opportunity to get up close to and understand. And I know it's kind of like being like choosing your favorite child. You can't do it. But is there a company among those companies that you have studied that really stands out for a particular reason at all? Is there, I don't want you to pick.
Yeah, they all stand out. Thus, I wrote them. Like, that would be my statement. But I think if I have a personal preference of brands, I like warmer, fuzzier, emotionally nurturing brands. So that could be anything from a brand like Starbucks, which I really find to be that. Ritz-Carlton, though, I must say the Ritz-Carlton version of nurturing, when you get at the corporate level, is much more gravitas and formal, and Starbucks a little bit more relaxed. Something like Zappos was just purely playful. And it was nurturing and wowful, and it did it in the context of play. So these are all brands that I really love because of that. There are other brands that I very much enjoyed working with, but the nurturing elements were probably not the same.
Yeah. So Zappos is one of my favorite brands, and I mentioned to you off air that we'd taken some of our clients on an excursion or a field trip to study Zappos and Pike Place Fish Markets and Disney as well on that same trip. And I guess I want to just unpick the customer experience and the formulation of it. But I guess before we get to that, because one of the myths that I mentioned to you just before we started is that there's this, well, I've come across it, maybe others have not, but this is my experience, is that some people seem to believe that a customer experience is too human dependent. It can't be systemized. Therefore, it can't be scaled. Therefore, it's an inconsistent thing. And I guess I want to just talk about how we can embed a wonderful customer experience for our patients and understand the benefits that'll bring us. But I'd like to just speak to that scaling piece. You know, it's impossible to scale service kind of routine because it's too independent on the individual.
Well, I'll lead credence to it for a moment. Like I'll honor the fact that we are all human beings and that we can have a great day, we can have a bad day, and the experiences we deliver varies based on the moods of humans. Undeniably true. If we hire really bad humans, as a rule, we don't know how to select people who are capable of delivering great experiences or who have a service mindset. If we don't hire service mindset oriented people, then we can pretty much assure it's not going to scale. It's not even going to manifest, let alone scale. And then when we do hire well, we need to keep grooming it, nurturing it, pruning it, feeding it in order for it to grow and scale. But truly, if you could not scale this, then there would be no competitive advantage for it. Everybody would just give up on it. The truth of the matter is, all things being equal, two dentists equally competent, equally qualified, similarly priced, with the same marketing acumen, it's going to come down to the execution of the brand promise day in and day out, and whether or not those patients walk out the door, not only with the same quality of care, but walk out the door feeling something special about the time that they spent there. And literally, I have consulted with dental offices in the United States where we've converted, you know, old houses, and we've had people come in through the kitchen with the smell of chocolate chip cookies, right? That's scalably different than the more sterile and austere offices that many of the competitors in that market had. So I'm not saying that that's the approach, but I'm saying you can define what you want to be known for, deliver and execute it on scale, and then the humans either add to it, and on some days, granted, they may detract from it.
Yeah. So it sounds like the beginning piece of that puzzle is define what you want to be known for. Can we just unpack that a little bit? And again, perhaps using some of the brands that you've had the opportunity to work with, I'm just curious to understand the thought process that goes into that definition and how people might uncover that for themselves.
Yeah, so I've worked with all these brands and helped consult for them. So let's take a Pike Place Fish where they throw fish, tiny retail space in Seattle, 1,400 square feet of retail, mostly known for throwing fish and having a kind of Gregorian chant back and forth among the fishmongers. People come there, flock there, take pictures, love to see the fish get thrown, love to try to catch the fish sometimes. The bottom line, that whole experience is built on the premise that we want every single person who comes up to the stand to feel world famous. Mm-hmm. It came off, and we call this a way we serve statement. It's what we want every person to feel. So to be world famous means as you walk up, I'm going to look at you. I'm going to say, wow, glad you're here. You know, what have you done? You know, why are you in Seattle? Finding out that you're on a tour with your colleagues and you're showing your clients what they can learn about experiences. We're going to just take you backstage, bring it in. Because if you were, you know, an incredible celebrity of great import, then we would be giving you that attention, right? You would get that naturally. We want you to feel extremely important, very celebrity-like when we interact with you. Every single customer, every single time. And if we don't, we coach each other on where we miss opportunities to do that. We try to treat each other that way. When we walk in the morning, we treat our colleague like, wow, this is a celebrity in our presence, go figure. And that energy that you bring to that changes the way that fish market behaves relative to four other fish markets within three blocks of it, all of whom are getting their fish from the exact same vendor, same distributor, getting them off the fishing boats in Elliott Bay. And what I will tell you is that Pike Place Fish Market, once it got it dialed in on who it wanted to be world famous Pike Place Fish, by that I mean I create world famous experiences for everyone I interact with. Once they got that, they went from fourth to first in sales. And the cumulative sales of all the other three fish markets combined does not approximate what Johnny and his team were able to sell through at his market. No differentiated product. They just transformed their business and made their competition irrelevant, except cumulatively. He made them irrelevant through the experience that his people deliver every day.
Yeah, and actually, you know, when you read the Fish Philosophy book and you watch the videos online, you watch it and you think, how could this be? Yeah, you know, how could this be true? But once, of course, you get there, I think one of their phrases is catch the energy or feel the energy, and you certainly do. You can feel that energy, and you do feel. A phrase that I like to use, you feel noticeably cared for is how I describe it.
Yeah. And I think it's both cared for and cared about, if you think about it, right? Like, you know, cared for in that you nailed the transactional elements splendidly. Such care that somebody feels special in and of that, just that you were so attentive. But what if I cared about you, like where you came from, where you're going, how this matters to you, the impact of what I'm doing? I want to care for you and I want to care about it, about you, the so what of the what, right? I think you're spot on with that energy. And those guys generate it. And it's mostly guys, by the way, burly fishmongers. They generate that from about 4 in the morning when they're putting up the ice on the fish show, planting all the fish on the ice show or on the fish show, and then doing that all the way through the end of the day. It's remarkable.
It is absolutely remarkable. And you touched on something that I didn't realize until I got there. And that is just how small that shop is, right? And yet the throng of people surrounding it was enormous, and I think probably the main draw card in some respects for the whole marketplace for dentists listening to that is you don't necessarily have to be huge. You don't necessarily have to invest a lot of money in that experience. It was, like you said, the product is the fish and it's being served on ice like every other market. So could we just kind of linger on that point for a second and talk about, again, maybe another misconception that it's all about gizmos and gadgets. I mean, it can be, but it doesn't have to be about that. So can we just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, I would say most gizmos and gadgets really only create parity and only for a while until new gizmos and gadgets show up. And then you have to buy those to stay at parity. It's a very ruthless game of technology out there today. But the human factor remains pretty consistent. People want to be recognized. They want to feel important. They want to be appreciated. They want to be heard. They want someone to remember them. They want someone to remember that they went to X, Y, or Z for vacation, right? And that doesn't take a lot. If you have a customer relationship management database, as most of us do, you can put some of that personal information in certain fields there, and you just refresh your staff, make sure your staff checks in on that data before they interact with every patient. Before I got on this, you know, interaction with you, I made sure I revisited your website, even though I viewed it, you know, a couple of weeks ago. It's the thing you do when you want someone to realize this is just not another interview for me. Or I'm, you know, vice versa. I'm not just your next interview and you can't wait to get to the next person. And I think that element, teaching that and taking the time to facilitate that, even the way we listen to our staff so they get a sense that this is important. I'm important. I'm listened to. I'm cared about. I'm appreciated. Well, guess what? We expect you to do that for them too. And this is really a big thing for something like a Ritz-Carlton, where literally we have people taking care of guests who are not in the same socioeconomic class as the guests that they're taking care of.
Yeah.
And yet we say we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen as our way we serve statement, right? We serve ladies and gentlemen, and we do this by elevating the senses, and there's more to it. But the niche here is to say, you are a lady or gentleman. We are going to demonstrate that in the way we care for you. When we select you, we listen to you very carefully. We understand these things that you prefer that you don't even know we're listening for. So maybe you're a prospect and you're talking to another prospect, and I overhear you talking about fresh squeezed mango juice. And on the first day you arrive, having been selected for the job, I'm going to make sure there's fresh squeezed mango juice at the Ritz-Carlton for you on your day of arrival. And when you say, hey, how did you know? I wasn't on a questionnaire of my preferences. We'll say, whatever it is that I did to be aware of that is what we expect from you. Radar on, antenna up. That's how we serve. And I think that's my message. None of that costs a whole bunch of money.
No.
But it does take some time, and it does take some attentiveness to the human in front of us and encouraging them to do the same.
Yeah. That's, again, so much to unpack there. You spoke a little bit about, you know, the first step being about deciding what you want to be known for. And I think getting clarity about that, you know, whether it's, you know, we're ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen, or any other type of statement that another company might have. Once you've decided what you want to be known for, how do you kind of turn that into a repeatable process? How do you engage your team? How do you try and create consistency? Because we spoke at the beginning about, yes, humans have good days and bad days. But the consistency piece, again, how do we create the process? How do we design that?
I would first say that service professionals have a tighter bandwidth of good days and bad days. People who don't have a professionalism about it are just wildly swinging back and forth as the moods hit them. Right. There are days as professionals that we have to suck it up and we have to give our best face. Or you can see this sometimes where someone takes a call as, you know, their business is like, hello, yes. And then they, you know, they get a call from their spouse and then they're in a different.
I mean, it changes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like kind of lifted up a bit.
Like crossing the white line onto the field, isn't it? It's like when you get
it is.
Football, you walk across the line, you're in game mode.
Exactly. You're in the game and you're in game mode all the time, front facing. You know, it's why Disney talks, you know, kind of about those kind of character roles and being in the front of the house or being on stage. So to get to your point, I think it really is people, process, technology focused, right? If we know this is what we're going to do. So in the case of Mercedes-Benz and our goal to transform that brand from something on the order of 32nd on the JD Power customer satisfaction index, a bragging rights index here in the United States, on a brand that's 32nd and goes to market with, you know, best or nothing as their tagline. 32nd means nothing, right? Like you are nothing. And Mercedes, the Daimler folks don't really like to be referred to that way. So, but it took a lot of that kind of conversation to say, look, you keep claiming you're best or nothing, but your customer satisfaction scores are terrible. You know, some months you're just competing with Mazda to be able to say, you know, we're a premier luxury experiential brand. No, I don't think so. So the point is, once you define it, in their case, we were driven to delight. We were going to delight every customer every time. We were going to measure it, not by asking how satisfied were you with your visit today, but how delighted were you?
Mm.
Oh my goodness. Early on, some of the scores on a scale of 0 to 10 on how delighted were zeros, with lots of narration about, are you kidding me, delighted? I mean, it's almost as though you treated me so badly at my dealership that I should be appreciative that I had the privilege of buying a $140,000 U.S. car, right? Like the anger was there. And so how do you mobilize that? If we're really going to have delight as our goal, we're going to ask about it instead of hide behind satisfaction, this cognitive variable. And we're going to then design for it. We're going to look at all the touch points in the brand. And this is true in an office setting. What are the most important touch points? They're the arrival touch point.
Yes.
That's arrival on your website. That's arrival on the phone. That's arrival in your office. And that arrival experience sets the whole tone for everything else. It's a major memorable event. If you think about your day, you don't remember everything that happened in your day. There are certain defining moments in the day that are more emotionally charged and that tend to be remembered. And so the same is true with visits to, you know, a clinic or an office. Mm. And so arrival is a big one, right? A transition from the waiting room to the treating area, right? All the handoffs that happen where I wonder, did the care I just received up to now, is that going to change?
Yes.
The uncertainties of what are going to happen. The care itself clearly is within the control of the dentist and the dental team, but then it may go back out to some appointment scheduling. It may go out to some billing interaction. There are all these moments that are, some of which are particularly significant, more significant than others. And so, it's operationalizing what are we going to do at the most valuable moments? Because we can't control everything. Let's just put our energy into the ones that are most likely to be remembered. And then you hit those with processes, with training. You teach people on how to elevate those moments. You get your people actively looking for how do we do it even better, because this moment really matters. And you have competitions within your teams to come up with ideas about how to improve the experience around certain moments in the customer experience. You ask them, how did we do overall? How did we do after one of those big moments? So that you're tracking those transactional pivot pieces, and you're also looking at the relational value that you're generating.
One of the things I've tried to work on in our own practice is using frameworks rather than scripts, so that we have conversational structure, so we achieve a conversational outcome, but without the rigidity of wearing someone else's words as your own clothing. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about scripts versus frameworks, and how do you kind of humanize the interaction without it feeling, like robotic, because, the customer or the patient says this and it's not on the script, and oh goodness, now I'm lost in the whole experience, and what was going so well ends up kind of feeling contrived at the end of it. So how do you create that humanity part of the process is what I'm trying to ask.
Oh, I love that question. And, last year I wrote a book about an Aussie company, Macquarie Telecom, and now Macquarie Technology Group. And they used to use this phrase around having freedom within boundaries. And I think it was really helpful for me. I think that's really how you have to operate. Well, more of this, less of that. Here's what the boundaries are. Here's what the end goal is. Once you start giving too many of those, here are some shortcuts to get there. People tend to use those shortcuts over and over again. The Ritz-Carlton, for example, we would try to show what refined service language was. So we'd say something like, okie dokie is never going to happen at the Ritz-Carlton. It's just not the language of the Ritz-Carlton. Then we started giving some shortcuts like my pleasure. And then we would have guests complaining that I got my pleasure to death, literally, or we would give instructions, service instructions like, don't just point to someplace, escort the guest, right? Well, that's fine. And then you have to set some limits, because we had complaints about ladies and gentlemen walking into the bathroom with somebody because they were so eager to just show them where the bathroom was, right? So there's all this sort of, what is it that we're trying to achieve? We're trying to achieve someone feeling service tangibly, right? So to do that, we're going to walk with them somewhere, or we might even write something down as instructions. If I tell you to just go down there and turn right, that's wholly different than if I walk with you and help you until you can see where to turn right. And so I think what you're trying to do with all of this is explain to someone, how do people perceive that they have been served? And that is done not by scripting. And most of the time that becomes robotic, and AI can do that for us right now. And that's what AI is doing largely.
I want to shift gear for a second and talk about teams, people, and leaders as well. And off air, we spoke about perhaps one of my favorite business people that I've not had the pleasure to meet, but you have, but I've had the pleasure to read about, think about, study, and that's Tony Hsieh. And I wanted to ask about the qualities of leaders in these service-driven organizations and how that flows down to the team. Obviously, Zappos is incredibly well-known for their culture. We all know and understand that, but what's that look like in other businesses? But perhaps if we could start with a leader, because I suspect it's going to be driven top down, perhaps, or maybe it's bottom up, or maybe it's all together. But I'm just interested, because this podcast is going to be mainly listened to by practice owners. What are the sort of qualities you've observed in the leadership teams of such service-driven organizations?
I think that they are so different. We used to do a lot of work on leaders and say, these are leadership qualities, right? And then you realize, well, those are leadership qualities for certain situations. And then you need a whole different set of leadership qualities if you're going to do a turnaround, right? So But I think to lead a human-centered organization, you had better value people. This is not human resources that you think about like other resources, in tangible resources in your office. If you don't understand that your business is personal, it's people making personal connections with others, then you probably can't do this. I'm not saying you can't run a business that's operationally really efficient and, you know, buttoned up and you can make a lot of money and last a long time, but it's not going to feel really good to your people who work for you. You're going to have a lot more churn. The customers, they will tolerate you until they get a coupon with somebody else who really shows that they care more. Maybe you can fake caring and you're really good at that and get by. But in the end of the day, it's authentically realizing that we're not doing this business by ourselves. We're not solopreneurs, right? Like, we have to rely on other human beings. And a lot of our success is going to depend upon how well we treat them and how well they treat the people that we serve. And if you get that at your core, everything else about you can be okay. I mean, you obviously have to be optimistic because business is brutal. And I think optimism is a helpful trait. It certainly needs to be guarded and tempered by reality. It's not a fantasy optimism. It's just looking constantly for opportunities, that growth mindset that, you know, that we are chasing here, that sense of hope and mastery and being able to activate people's autonomy. All those things are the critical elements. And I think if you have that, right, if you just keep working on that, you're a reasonably effective communicator, constantly working on listening effectively. In the Paul Tillich world of, you know, the first act of love is to listen. It's the first act of leadership too. And so if you listen a lot to your people and know what's on their hearts and minds, this thing works out. I mean, I love business. I love going into companies, working with leaders who couldn't be more different than one another, and watching how they create success. And almost all of it starts at the heart and works outward.
Dentistry is a healthcare profession, and yeah, care is embedded into the very description of the work that we do. And caring about, obviously, our patients, which most of us kind of got into the industry in the first place for. We care about other people and their well-being. But it is easy to kind of get really caught up in the technical aspects of dentistry. And so for those practice owners listening, or even for other people listening as well, I really appreciate that heart outward approach, because it's that human connection. I'm a big fan of Brené Brown, I have to tell you.
I'm that Brené Brown freak, yeah.
Me too. I have an intellectual crush on Brené Brown. I use the word intellectual in there deliberately and purposefully, because otherwise it just sounds weird. But the point I'm trying to make is, I remember her saying that connection is what gives meaning and purpose to human life. And yeah, I feel like our business is an extension of that, creating connection and interaction. So that heart outward piece is fantastic. I wanted to talk a little bit about Tony, if we can. Yeah. Sad to hear about his passing, as all of us were. When we took our clients to visit Zappos, the emotions of the staff were still very raw sometime after his passing. Oh. You could see that there was still a lot of, I suppose, grief and sadness being experienced by the team. I wanted to ask, because Zappos is a bit of a poster child as a service-driven business, and I wanted to ask a little bit about what your observations of Tony were, how you interacted with him, how you found him, and yeah, given his background with Link Exchange prior to Zappos,
yeah,
how all that came about.
First and foremost, Tony Hsieh was an introvert. He's a genius, an unbelievable genius. And he was playing on the chessboard five moves ahead of most people. That said, he also craved a sense of community. And so this introvert who needed a sense of community and kind of was probably a puer eternus in the Latin and psychological terms, a boy forever. And all of that made him charming and very confusing. I mean, this is a guy who did not like to interact in large settings and was shy, but in small groups with a few of his closest friends, he was amazing. And I think all of that just led him down a painful path. He was also a big thinker and a dreamer. You know, he was the kind of guy who was trying to change downtown Las Vegas and make it an enterprise zone own in a magnificent way, and probably got over his skis on that too. All in all, there's a great podcast about him that I would encourage you to review. I'm forgetting the actual name now, but I'm glad to send it along. And if listeners want to reach out to me, they can as well. But it really, I think, chronicles the demise and that sort of emperor has no clothes world and a drug-fueled sort of way of managing the pain. And that led to the final demise. Jewel, the singer Jewel, was one of the ones who confronted him in the final days, just saying, Tony, you're in deep trouble. You need to kind of go a different direction. And he just cut her off. So you get to that point, I think, where you get too successful. You have so much money. He was a billionaire in his 30s, right? That kind of changes you a bit.
Yeah, probably would, I imagine.
You and I could try it, though. I mean, my 30s have long gone. I'm still, I think, you know, I'll just take double the millions now.
I've got the gray hairs to disprove my 30s. You know, I have two teenage kids as well who are...
That'll put you away right there.
Yeah. Right there. So I wanted to just ask about his drive, his ambition, because he really did transform the business from, you know, when I think Nick... Yeah, was the founder, and you know, Tony came along initially as an angel investor, and then obviously into, you know, the board and the CEO and so on.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask a bit about the transformation of Zappos from selling shoes online to becoming the behemoth that it has become. And ultimately they sold to Amazon, as you know, and I know, for a tidy sum.
Yep.
What was the transition like? Because the reason I'm asking is because there'll be people listening to this podcast who might feel like they have, I suppose, a garden variety, austere kind of practice, and they're thinking, I want to start making some changes. How do I, as the leader, as the owner, need to think? How do I need to show up? How do I need to...
Yeah, you know, if you don't mind, I'd rather, and it's not because I don't want to talk about Tony. I've talked about Tony forever. I think a better example is Johnny Yokoyama, the owner of the Pike Place Fish Mart. And I would say that for a couple of reasons. First, it's a single business. He decided not to move it across the country, but he could have grown it had he wanted to. His goal was to develop the next generation of talent.
Yes.
He had many buyers who were willing to pay him more money to buy the Pike Place Fish Market, but he gave it over to his boys, as he liked to call them, people that he'd helped develop. Plenty of money, and those guys certainly had a lot of loans on their heart in the early days. But he wanted to develop the team that could continue the culture. You know, his fundamental belief is that he wanted to create a world famous difference for those he served. And his background was being in an internment camp, a Japanese American internment camp in the United States, having his father's business been lost when a government decision decided to round up all of those, mostly at that time, flower growers and produce growers in the Pike Place Market area. And so his father's produce business was completely taken away. They were rounded up, taken to these relocation camps. And then when we came back, they lived in government-owned housing. So he had never inherited his father's business, but he wanted to make sure that he created a business that people would want to inherit and that he had developed people who could inherit it when the time came. So I will tell you, I think the model is more build it so that you can avail the next generation to run it. You know, very few of us want to build a business and then it goes away as soon as we retire. So figuring out how to create that. And my neighbor, literally two doors over, sells dental practices. That's what he does. And his wife's a dentist, right? So I have a very clear appreciation for the nature of building a business that's sellable.
So let's talk a bit about what drives enterprise value then, because again, it's one of the things I'm really passionate about, is creating a business that you can sell. You know, where does this service culture fit into enterprise value?
Yeah. I mean, Starbucks has benefited from it immensely in its perception. I think they just recently became the second, the second most economically valuable fast food restaurant chain. They had been first for a long time, but a lot of that was predicated on the multiplier that they got from return business, repeat business, cost of acquisition of new clients, the strength of their loyalty program. Now, their loyalty program is very well developed from the standpoint of what it takes to earn a free drink and get your free birthday drink and all those other things. But in the early days, a lot of when I first met Howard Schultz, I was suggesting we needed a loyalty program, and he laughed at me and said, you know, look, if we give the 13th drink away, we've just diluted the value of the first 12 by virtue of some 1/12 ish thing. And he was really strong on it until the economy turned and the 28, you know, frequency visit, highest loyal customers weren't coming in 28 times in a month. Yeah. And then he started to come up with some incentive programs. The combination of well-crafted, incentivized repeat business, along with the way customers were craving the experience, created incredible multipliers on their enterprise value. And good, they should. I mean, if you're the street and this brand has a loyal following, that the repeat business is super sticky. You don't need to spend a lot for acquisition.
Yeah, I always say that dentistry, while not a subscription business, has almost subscription elements in it, in the recurring nature of the business. You know, our patients will typically come back for their 6-monthly checkup and clean.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously the treatment that needs to be done off the back of that. And one of the things we always talk about is giving patients a really compelling reason to return. And that compelling reason to return is usually clinical in nature, so that they understand the seriousness of the oral conditions that they may have. And we present that in a certain way. And then what I'm picking up now is if we combine that with a really well-crafted, really well-thought-out, really well-executed customer experience, while we're not necessarily running a subscription business a la Netflix or Spotify or whoever, we create that repeatable, sustainable earnings and that stickiness, like you say, the cost of acquisition, the referrals, the, you know, the repeat business, that's going to add tremendous enterprise value, which I love.
Huge. Yeah.
I'm curious to ask, because I've not seen this, but that's not to say it doesn't happen, but in the United States, do you see formalized loyalty programs like the one you described for Starbucks being operated in a business, maybe not a dental practice, but I'm just trying to think, is there a way of incorporating a formalized structure of that nature into a practice? I'd never really
thought. A lot of professional practices, you see referral incentive programs, like in for your friends. So there's that. The actual, you know, you stick around, we're going to get a discount for a longstanding loyalty. No, but I advise my clients, professional service clients in and out of dentistry. I'm not a dental expert. You wouldn't want to come to me. You definitely want to go to you. But my clients in general, to look for ways to incentivize people that have nothing to do with money per se or some gamification model.
Yeah.
So I'd much rather know, you know, that there are certain things, you have certain interests and preferences, and some of the events that I might sponsor, you might have exclusive access to.
Yeah.
When my dentist is able to get me access to something that is near and dear to my heart, or he invites me to participate with them in some social giving program, you know, that's a whole different relationship with them. I obviously love their dental care, but I also love their humanity, and I love that they allow me to do good in the world alongside of them, or I love that they allow me to experience the arts in a certain way, that because they know me and they've created this special offering that gives me some access I would not have otherwise gotten, curated experience relevant to me. So yeah, I think I see it happening, but I think that, you know, punch card sort of mindset, I wouldn't go there anyway. But I don't see it happening. I will tell you really quickly, I lived in Colorado for the longest time, and I had a dentist in Colorado I loved and adored. And so when I first came to Florida, which is a long schlep from Colorado, I kept going back to my dentist in Colorado. It was very expensive. It was tedious. I said, okay, finally enough. You love the guy, but this has got to end.
Yeah.
You've got to get a dentist in Florida. And so my search for a dentist was absolutely abysmal. And so, I mean, the industry, for as much as I thought it was like the guy in Colorado, there was such variability. I had dogs defecating in the treatment area. You know, I had the whole range of experience. Pricing that was so not transparent that from a user experience perspective, I'm like, I think they're shysting me. I have no idea if this is legitimate because it's so convoluted. To finally finding somebody after sticking with a guy for a little bit here who was, again, I just dreaded, not from the experience. Like, we think it's pain and discomfort. It wasn't that at all. It was just having to hear him talk politics for most of the time while my mouth was unable to reciprocate, right? But I stayed with it because I was tired.
Yeah.
I was worn down.
Yeah.
But then finally, I've gotten to the dentist that I absolutely adore again. And I can't imagine leaving. And I've referred my wife to that dentist. I've referred my daughter to that dentist. And yeah, I'm loyal. I'm loyal now. New loyalty here.
Yeah, I love that. Interesting. Just going back to the punch card mentality, we certainly don't do that. What we've done in our practice is You spoke about social enterprise, and it's really interesting. We partnered with a group called B1G1, which I'm not sure that would be making a huge splash in the United States, but it's buy one, give one. And essentially it's when people come back for their 6-monthly checkup and clean, we'll donate a, 100 days of life-giving water to those people in Africa that need it. And so our mission is to donate 1 million days. And it's actually something that's really been very good, because at the end of the appointment, we give them a little thank you card that says, thank you, just by coming here to have your teeth, scaled and cleaned and your examination performed, we've donated 100 days on your behalf. And so every single time that someone comes in for their exam and clean, we donate 100 days. And we've actually gone past 1 million days by now. But it's been great. And it's what it's really done is it's galvanized our customer base, our patient base, into a cause that, I live in a place called Canberra in Australia. It's a seat of government. It's the capital. And so very socially aware customer base, people want to do good in the world and make an impact. And so that's been really useful. So I think your point about getting engaged in some causes, I think is really useful. And we found that to be really a good way of getting people to come back too.
So I don't know the B1G1 per se, but I know Blake Mycoskie, who started Tom's Shoes.
Yeah.
And it was such a breakthrough. Like, buy shoes, do good. If all things being equal, I'd rather do that, right? And sometimes it's not even all things being equal. It's like, this is the way I can do good when I would have otherwise not. And maybe it's a little more expensive for me, but sometimes I'm willing to do that, right? And in many cases, it's more about giving me chances to do good, right? And you are, by just coming to you, gives me a chance to do good without having to do anything else.
Yeah, doesn't cost you anything, which is great. If you are organizing a dinner party or a barbecue or some sort of gathering where there's going to be food and maybe the occasional wine or beverage of your choice, and you are thinking about the people who fascinate you and interest you in this space, who would you have around your dinner table to have great conversations with on this particular topic?
Oh my goodness. This is a sad answer. I hate to do this to you, but my life has been so blessed that I think I've experienced most all of them.
In the same environment at the same time?
Never in the same environment at the same time. It'd be interesting to see them in the same environment. Let me give you one of the people that I absolutely love and admire. And I really can't believe I've had the good fortune of knowing him, but that is the guy that everybody thinks of when they think of Starbucks. It's Howard Schultz. And to me, he was one of the greatest mentors of all time in terms of how to think at scale in customer experience terms and to actually define your brand as an experience brand. So to me, any chance I get to be with Howard is wonderful. But then if you put him in juxtaposition with, someone like a Gene Bliss, who's the first chief customer officer of all time, again, a friend and somebody I know, I'd just love to see those two talk. I'd like to be over on that side, with the apron on, just overhearing what they were saying in the corner. That I would be fascinated by. But really, is there, I'm blessed and I don't feel like I have anybody that I would just need to go and experience. And if I would, I would be just persistently trying to figure out how to reach them. That's not a tip I give people a lot. We think people are unapproachable, hard to get through a lot of gatekeepers often. But if you're persistent enough and you're not too stalker-like,
fantastic.
Don't cut yourself short. That's all I would say.
Well, on the back of your book here called Driven to Delight, which I highly recommend to all of our listeners and, of course, any other books you've written as well, I was interested to see some of the people who had written on the back of the dust cover. Guy Kawasaki, for example, who...
I love Guy, yeah.
He's an incredible human being. He's a chief evangelist of Canva, which is a company we in Australia love because it's an Australian-based company. And then, of course, you've got Doug Lipp down there from Disney U as well and other people as well. The reason I bring that up is I've always had this fascination that the best ideas for dentistry often come from outside of our industry. And that's why I look to companies like Zappos or Disney or like when we went to Pike Place Fish Markets. So for those people listening to the program today, some companies that they might want to think about, examine, model, learn from. You've mentioned a few already. Starbucks is, obviously high praise indeed. We've spoken a bit about Mercedes-Benz and Zappos and Disney. Are there any other companies that perhaps may or may not be as well known as those large brands that you think are worthy of examination for our audience?
Yeah, there's a jeweler called Zamir Kazam, and just amazing. They create custom engagement jewelry, and they help men tell the story of their engagement to them and design this jewelry around the story. And then they help coach the man to be able to tell the story when they give the ring. So it's not like, hey, here's your wedding ring. Just that art of extracting stories, infusing creative design around stories, and then shifting that into being able to create an experience through that story. So that's, this is a quick example. I've just written a book that'll be out in May, that is about Amazon One Medical. Now, Amazon's a name that's recognizable, but One Medical is a small little startup in the Silicon Valley that basically said, here in the United States, from a healthcare perspective, why does the patient have to sit in the waiting room and the exam room? Why do we have those seating moments? Does every patient really need to get weighed? How much of that is the theater of it? And a lot of all of that from this really brilliant Harvard-trained internal medicine specialist, Tom Lee, was to take as many of those pain points out of the experience as possible. And in his case, you know, this, he started this when people were calling up for appointments and the only way they could get an appointment was to call up. They weren't doing it on an app. So this group was developing an app that allowed that. They were way ahead on virtual medicine, because they had the app in place. Almost all their communications between the doctor and the patient are text-based. I ultimately became a subscription model of sorts. Mm. Your insurance is still involved in the pay for your care, but your access is on a small subscription fee of a couple hundred dollars a year, which gets you much more same day, next day access than you could get in this country. So all of that is a company that I think you pay attention to, particularly in healthcare.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is. And then with the Amazonification of it, it's fascinating to look at what happens when you have a supply chain company and a cloud company.
Yes.
And incorporate that in a world of human care. So the book, which is called All Business is Personal, is this conversation about how much human centeredness, how much technology, when do you play which, how do you make sure you have enough people at the right moments? How do you make sure you're leveraging your technology for efficiency and ease and self-service? So that's a company I would also put on the register.
Yeah. So ladies and gents, certainly keep an eye out for those companies, go and study them. And your book is coming out in May.
Yep.
Best place to grab a copy of the new book?
You know, I think in Australia, it takes so long to get a book down there and it gets expensive to get books down there from. I think if you're into audio or you're into Audible, you could do it through any of your booksellers down there. I should know. Dimmicks, I think, is one, right? They should have an audio.
Well, Joseph, I want to take a moment to say thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, your insights, and your experiences with us on the podcast. If people want to find out more about your book, your work, is the best place to find them online, or is where would you like us to?
Yeah. I think if you have my name, you can find me. I'm mercilessly by my name everywhere online. JosephMichelli.com will get me on the website. And then from there, I'm Joseph Michelli on LinkedIn and everywhere else. So if you can spell it, you can yell it, you can find me.
Yeah, I love that. If you can spell it, you can yell it. Lovely. Awesome. Well, Joseph, once again, mate, you've been a very kind and generous guest today. And I just want to take a moment to thank you from all of us here at Savvy Dentist, myself, our listeners, and our whole team that go to put the show together. You've been a fun guest to talk to, really insightful guest to talk to, and I appreciate the work you do.
So as I say thank you, I'm going to revise an earlier answer. That barbecue, anytime you want to come along, I'd love to have you as the person I'm talking to. Thanks so much for your kindness today.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you, Jase.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.